Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're very excited tonight to have Bruce Cameron back in Denver with his new novel, The Dogs of Christmas. As many of you remember, Bruce was a humor columnist for the Rocky Mountain News, and he's eventually award winner for humor and also the 2011 NSNC Newspaper Columnist of the Year. His first novel, A Dog's Purpose, spent 48 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. DreamWorks is making it into a movie, and Bruce and his writing partner have written the screenplay, so we all have that to look forward to. A Dog's Journey, the sequel, was published in 2012 and also became an instant New York Times bestseller. We all remember and loved Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which became the hit TV series on ABC. His other books include Emery's Gift, How to Remodel a Man, and Eight Simple Rules for Marrying My Daughter. Will you please join me in welcoming Bruce Cameron?
Thank you, Marty. I can't tell you how exciting it is for me to be at the Tattered Cover. It's regarded by authors that I run into all over the country as being the premier bookstore since right here in Denver. So you all have a lot to be proud of. I did my very first book signing here at the Tattered Cover with Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. I had, at that point, absolutely no idea what I was doing, and that still applies today. I love coming back to Denver. I ran into something really rare and unexpected today, which was an oxygen molecule. I don't know. I've been just doing this since I got here. I've been looking for an oxygen bar, and I would pay any amount of money. I would just go in and say, just line them up. I'll do a shot of everything. It's such a great place. I love how everywhere you look, you see these bicycles, and they're all clean and beautiful. In Los Angeles, the bicycles are all stolen. And the air in L.A. is a little different because you can see it, and you can chew it, and you can spit it out. And here, I'm not even sure there is air here. One of the things we're doing tonight is we are honoring and benefiting Life is Better Rescue. This is a rescue that has been in existence for just a couple of years. In 2 years, I believe they have rescued 2,000 animals. And their mission is to go into shelters and places that are kill shelters and find those death row animals and yank them off death row and find them a forever home so that they don't have to face the gas or the needle or whatever they were headed for. I'm very proud to be affiliated with Life is Better Rescue. I come to it genetically because my daughter is the president of Life is Better Rescue. So, but for all the work you've done and all the people that work for Life is Better Rescue, we owe you a great hand. So thank you very much. So over time, what I do in these kinds of things has changed. It used to be that I actually made a living going around giving speeches. And I made more money doing that than I did selling books. It was my occupation. But because I could tell jokes, like I wrote Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. Like rule number one, if you pull in my driveway and honk, you better be delivering something because you're sure as heck not picking anything up. Or my favorite, which is rule number five, you may have heard that in today's world, sex without a barrier method of some kind can kill you. Well, let me elaborate on that. I am the barrier, and I will kill you. So it was easy to talk about that, and then I wrote a book called How to Remodel a Man. That's up here, too, which was really easy because a recent study shows that 75% of the time, men are thinking of one of three things: sports, sex, or nothing. So I've always said, if you do it like a brain scan of a man, it'll be like a map of Wyoming at night. There'll be like all this dark with these little points of light here and there. But then I wrote A Dog's Purpose, and everything changed for me because, well, am I going to stand up here and insult dogs for 45 minutes? I know a couple of dog jokes. Here's my dog joke. So there's these two brothers, Nathan and Charlie. And Nathan is the hard worker, and he is just always got his nose to the grindstone, and he supports his mom. His mom and Charlie both live with him. Charlie kind of lives in the basement and can't get out of the basement, and that's Charlie. And Nathan finally breaks. He says, you know, I cannot take another day of this. Charlie, you're going to have to take care of you get two responsibilities here, our mom and my dog, because I'm going to get on a cruise. I'm not going to have a cell phone. I'm not going to have any contact with the outside world. Can you handle that, Charlie? Charlie says, yeah, dude, I can handle that. So Nathan gets on the boat, and he can't stand it. He's got to know what's going on. So finally, after about 3 or 4 days, he goes to the ship-to-shore radio, calls the shore, gets his brother on the phone. Says, Charlie. And Charlie says, hey, Nathan. And he says, so tell me what's going on. How's my dog? He said, oh, well, your dog got killed. And Nathan says, Charlie, you don't tell me something like that. You got to break it to me. You say, look, your dog jumped the fence this morning, and we're really concerned. And then when I call back, you say, yeah, we still haven't found your dog. And then finally, when I'm prepared for it, then you say, bad news, your dog's dead. Charlie says, dude, you are so right. I'm so sorry. Nathan says, all right, well, that's okay, Charlie. So how's mom? He said, well, mom jumped the fence this morning. And that is, that's 75% of the dog jokes I know right there. I do know there's one about there's a dog, and he's always been fed wet dog food with a little bit of leftovers from dinner mixed into it. And then one day the owner pours a bunch of dry pellets into the bowl. And the dog looks at it and says, what the hell is this? And the owner says, you can talk? And he says, yeah, I can talk. He says, why haven't you talked before? And the dog says, well, there's never been a problem before. So I could stand up here and try to string out another 30 minutes of dog jokes, but I'm out. So what I've discovered over time is that it's more fun and more interesting to sort of steer the conversation and make it a conversation, and steer the conversation in the direction that you want to take it. I mean, you may have things that you want to talk about that I have no idea are on your mind, and therefore what I stand up here and prattle about will be of no interest to you. So I'd like you to all be thinking, do I have a question I want to ask or a comment I want to make? And when that question or comment lands, we'll just deal with it. That's sort of become my style, if you will. So I do want to tell you a little bit, though. I am going to read from this book in a little bit. It's The Dogs of Christmas, and I want to tell everyone here that a portion of the sale of this book, or if you've got that magic slip of paper, I guess any book that you buy tonight will go to Life is Better Rescue. And then for every copy of this book that you buy tonight, I personally am donating $2 to Life is Better Rescue so they can continue their excellent work. So think about who might like a Christmas gift. We'll talk about this book. I'll tell you a little bit of what it's about. And I want to tell you, so I lost my dad recently. This isn't a joke. My dad died a week ago, and I've been thinking about him a lot. And I wanted to tell this story about him because it just so personifies my dad for me. When I was a little boy, my dad was kept trying to teach me something, which over long experience, eventually we all learned is impossible. But at that point in life, he was trying to instruct me, and so he was out washing the car. And he says, Bruce, I have here in my hand a hose. Can I do this? I have here in my hand
a hose, and I'm going to give it to you. And I said, oh, great, can I spray the car? He says, no. Can I spray the dog? No. He says, pay attention, Bruce. I want you to fill the bucket half full of water. So I fill the bucket half full of water. I don't know what it is with little boys and hoses. Have you ever noticed, though? There's something going on there. So I fill the bucket. And then my dad says, now, what do you suppose would happen if I picked up the bucket and I swung it up over my head? And I said, the water would come out. And he said, no, the water would not come out due to something called centrifugal force. I said, no, Dad, it'll come out. Because if there's anything a little boy knows about, it's gravity. I mean, I had skinned my knee, I had fallen off the fence, I'd fallen out of the tree right over our heads just a few days before, so I knew all about gravity. He says, no, it's going to stay in the bucket. I said, no, Dad, it's going to come out. He said, all right, stand back. So I stood back, and he picked up that bucket, and he swung it once, and he swung it twice, and he swung it over his head, and it hit the branch right over his head. I said, told you. So at this point, was I fortunate enough that anybody here has actually got a question for me that they would like to steer the conversation toward? Yes, the young lady in front.
I'm not a plant, I swear. Can you tell us about the dog in the picture?
That dog is Tucker. And he came to me in a very unique way, which actually influences the storyline behind The Dogs of Christmas. So in a very odd way, this book is based on a true story. Tucker and his brothers and sisters were dropped off at a shelter in a cardboard box at birth. And it just so happened that Life is Better Rescue had a lactating German Shepherd who had just weaned her pups. So, you know, the problem with having a newborn pup at a shelter is that they can't they had to bottle feed. That would be so difficult, and it takes so much human resource, and you know they've got so much work to do. So the only way these dogs could survive would be if this German Shepherd would step up to the pump, so to speak. And so they brought the German Shepherd in these brand new puppies and said, you know, hey, wild weekend. And the German Shepherd started to nurse the pups. And so that is how Tucker survived. And then I got a call from my daughter, and she said, I've got this great dog for you. And I said, no, I mean, I live in L.A., you live in Denver, I'm not quite ready for a dog. When it's the time is right, I'll adopt a dog locally. And she said, I'll be there Wednesday. So she showed up with Tucker. And Tucker's main function is to try to locate and destroy things that are under the carpet. I don't know what he thinks is under there, but he spends a lot of his time in excavation projects that I have not told our landlord about. And he just turned 2, and he weighs 26 pounds. I kept saying, you're going to get bigger. You go, don't worry, you're going to get bigger. And he didn't get any bigger. So in the book, The Dogs of Christmas, I sort of came up with this magic idea about some puppies being left in a box. It's kind of the same story as my dog. So it gives me a great deal of pleasure to talk about Tucker and to thank my daughter for insisting that I take him, because I don't know what I would do without him now. Yeah.
What are the differences for you in writing a nonfiction newspaper column and writing fiction that's centered around dogs or humor?
Yeah, great question, because I started out writing this newspaper column, so the idea is, the question is, what happened? How did it feel to go from writing a newspaper column to writing books? Well, you know, it was an easy first step, because 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter was a column in the newspaper. That was back in the day of like 300 baud rate email, no web, it was just
internet, and I turned on my computer in the morning after it had been printed, and I started getting emails, and they came down, you know, that's what it was. It was really slow. But the good news is there was no spam. So it was, you know, nobody was offering to make any member of my body bigger or to wire transfer $180 million into my account. None of that was coming. It was just reaction to 8 simple rules for. So I knew I had something when I got up and got a cup of coffee and came upstairs and they were still coming. And I went downstairs and ate breakfast and I came up and they were still coming. It turns out, and I'm a genius for noticing this, that sometimes there's a problem between dads and teenage daughters. Nobody knew this before I came along, okay? That meant that 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which, by the way, the reason there are 8 was because I had a 700-word column, and that was it. So if it had been an 800-word column, it would be 9 rules. I mean, there's no magic number here. I just happened to pick 8 because I ran out of room. I had lots more rules. What I realized is I had touched a nerve with dads because being the father of a teenage girl is like living in a zombie movie. You open the door and there they are. And they smell like zombies, and they look like zombies, and they talk like zombies, you know? And they, you know, you get the guys, the boys who just kind of look like they evade my eyes, they don't offer their hand, they just mumble. Those boys, they make me very suspicious. I know they're up to something. But the boy who comes to my door, looks me in the eye, shakes my hand, calls me sir, those boys make me very suspicious. I know they're up to something. So I knew I had hit a nerve, and then the next thing was, well, what other obvious things are there? And I thought, well, there's a huge group of people out there who would like to change men. For want of a better term, let's call these people women. So I thought, I'm going to write a book for women on how to remodel a man, how to change a man, how to make a man the way you women would like them to be, which is utterly impossible. But I wrote all about it, and that did very well for me. That's the book that got me on Oprah. And so then I wrote another book that's not up here, and it's called 8 Simple Rules for Marrying My Daughter. Now, I really like that book. I mean, I really do. But here's my miscalculation. I wrote the book about how crazy it is when there's like a woman who's engaged to get married, how crazy everything goes. And what I didn't think about is, well, brides-to-be do not want to read about how crazy they are being. Their mothers do not want to. Their mothers are crazier. So the mothers don't want to read about how crazy they're being. And the father probably would like the book, but he didn't have any money. So no one bought that book. That's the story of that book. And that kind of ended my humor book career, because then it was like, you used to write humor books and you're done. So I wrote A Dog's Purpose. We were on writer's strike in Hollywood. And this meant I was walking around in a driveway with a sign. And I started to believe that maybe I was meant for something more than that. So I thought, I'm going to go home and I'm going to write a book. And I wrote A Dog's Purpose while we were on strike. And because I was allowed to do that. You're not allowed to write any screenplays or any television shows, but you're allowed to write a book. So I wrote A Dog's Purpose, sent it off. My agent said, I can sell this easier than anything I've ever sold. And then he couldn't sell it. And we sent it to every publisher, and they all turned it down. So it was done. So I'm, at this point, thinking, I'm over. Right? But then at Forge, this tiny little imprint of Macmillan called Tor Forge, they hired a brand new baby editor. She'd never been an editor before. And they say, here's your new office. And it was just stacked with manuscripts. And she says, what's all that? And they said, oh, those are manuscripts that we need to send back to the agents. So please, if you'll do that, if you'll send those back, then that's your office. So she goes in there and starts stuffing envelopes. And whenever I send in a book, I put a picture on it
I don't know why. This is what I do. So I had put a picture of a puppy on a dog's purpose. So as she picks up this thing, she sees a picture of a puppy. She's one of those rare people who likes puppies. So she flips it open and reads a few pages and thinks, oh, this looks interesting. And she took it home with her on the train. The next morning she comes in and she says, I know I've been on the job for 2 days now, but I want to publish this book. And so my agent calls me and said, I think we're going to get an offer on a dog's purpose. And there was an offer. And it was, as books go, it was not much money. And they only printed 15,000 copies. They didn't expect it to sell at all. But it opened on the New York Times bestseller list. And it actually spent 52 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list because it came back on last Christmas. So that is how that got started. Now, that wasn't your question at all. You said, what's it like? Or something like that. I answered it too well, didn't I? Like, God, everybody else is saying, I'm not going to ask a question. This guy won't shut up. Camille.
So, writing a dog's purpose, what was your thought process in writing from the dog's? Because to me, the best thing about that book is that it's from the dog's voice, the dog's point of view.
Yeah, so how did I get into the mind of a dog? Well, I'd already written How to Remodel a Man, so I was halfway there. I was already, right? I did the usual things. I carried a tennis ball around in my mouth for a couple of days. I dug a hole in the neighbor's yard. I went to the dog park, and what I learned, and then I read a bunch of books on dogs, and what I learned is so interesting to me. Nearly everything we know, or we think we know about dogs, is based on what we think we know about wolves. And nearly everything we think we know about wolves is derived from studies of wolves in captivity. And only recently have wolf scientists started to study wolves in the wild, which is really hard to do because they don't tend to just like sit around. They tend to run away. And then I don't know how they're doing it, but they started to realize all this stuff that we have in our heads about alpha males and alpha females and all these things are all us looking at wolves in the captivity and assigning them people values and saying that's how they do things. And then we said, so if wolves do it that way, dogs must do the same thing. So then we watch a bunch of dogs behaving and we think, okay, that must be the alpha wolf or the alpha dog because that's happening and this happening. Turns out in the wild, wolves, the alpha status is like a transferable thing. It passes from one wolf to another depending upon what's going on. So there is no alpha wolf according to the research I've read. And then according to the dog park, it's the same thing. I watched how one dog is dominant, and then another, like a little tiny dog walks in, all of a sudden the dominant dog is not dominant. It's not the little dog who's dominant. It's not that either. It's some other dog. They pass it back and forth. You know, they spend a lot of time sniffing each other. And I didn't do that when I was doing my research. I passed. Yeah. About the third time I tried it, somebody said, please stop. So I observed, and then to get into the mind of the dog, I just tried to think, well, what does it look like from a dog's perspective? But I will say that in A Dog's Purpose, the first book I wrote, I realized right away that I had a problem because the dog has an operative vocabulary of around 200 words. It Tucker's about a tenth of that, I think. But most dogs have about 200 words that they recognize, and most of them are nouns. Well, we've all read a book that has about a 200-word vocabulary. Remember that one? Run, Jane, run. Run, 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 like that. I knew that wouldn't be a big hit. So I had to come up with some rules for writing dog perspective stuff where a dog may not have a word for something. Like, Tucker does not understand stereo cables under the carpet, but he gets the concept. So he doesn't know what the word is, but if he saw the stereo cables, he'd say, oh, there they are. That's what I've been digging for. If you throw a ball, a dog might know it's a ball because you've told him it's a ball, but the first time he sees it, he doesn't know it's a ball. So I had to come up with rules like that. And then I also had to come up with adverbs but I would run into these problems sometimes where a dog wouldn't recognize something because he'd never heard the word before, and he thinks a school bus. He understands school bus because someone says there's a school bus. Then he sees a different kind of bus. To him, it's a silver school bus or it's a different colored school bus. So I had to go by rules like that. It was actually kind of hard because I wanted this to be a real dog. I mean, I've read books that are written from the perspective of a dog before, and they're just people that, are wearing a collar,
I wanted to be like a real dog. So it was hard. I love that question, though. Thanks very much.
I feel like the most successful part for me was that you went from life to life, that it was the same soul of the dog. And you say, now I wake up, and I'm in this place. And I no longer have that life, but now I have this life. Because I think that was really special.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I love hearing that. Yeah, here's what happens. I think I've figured out the way things work at DreamWorks. Everybody gets in a room, they turn off all the lights, and then they try to fumble their way toward a decision. And they're just bumping around in the dark going, is that you? Who is that? I mean, I do not understand why we had to get them the script in 6 weeks. It was so important. And then they haven't made a decision now in like 2 years. So I don't know. I don't know. But The Dogs of Christmas, I sold this to Fox 2000, and Temple Hill is the producer. And Temple Hill did, what was that little tiny thing? I think they called it Twilight. So they did Twilight, and Fox 2000 did Marley and Me. So they might have a little, so like the Twilight people understand about adapting a book, and the Marley and Me people understand dogs, Christmas, okay. You know, I'm writing the screenplay of this right now, and I think this will probably come out before A Dog's Purpose, just because of the way it's going. But that's movie making. Yeah, hi.
What advice would you give to aspiring authors?
What is the one piece of advice to an aspiring author? Go into something else. I read a book one time, I think it's Outliers or one of those, or Freakonomics or something like that. I think it was Outliers, and it was talking about how an expert in a profession seems to be somebody with 10,000 hours in. And I figure I've got my 10,000 hours in. But I wrote nine unpublished books before I sold my 10th, which was Eight Simple Rules, back in 2001. So I've been writing my whole life. I wrote a novel in college, and I really, I was so arrogant in college. I would love to go back there and just slap my face a few times and say, you're walking around like you're the big author on campus. Hi, you probably have heard of me. I'm Bruce Cameron. I'm writing a novel. Yeah. Yeah. Did not lead to any dating activity that I observed, however. Didn't work for that. Yes, hi.
Some of your columns in the Rocky Mountain News dealt with your parents' problems with technology, and I thought they were hilarious. Were they really true, or did you kind of make those up?
Did I make up the technical problems that my parents have with technology? Well, my father never adopted any tech. He was an early adopter. I mean, I swear that my dad bought the first fax machine. And then, you know, just sat there looking at it because he had no one to fax to. And he bought like the Sony, the very first VCR I ever saw was the size of a Buick. And then my dad brought home, and he put this, you know, gargantuan tape in. And you couldn't rent tapes or anything. It was just good for recording stuff. And but he got really good at that because later he took a tape of my sister's wedding and taped a tennis match over it. So that's how he was with technology. My mom, I'm technical support for my mom, and it has often gone like this. So mom, what does it say on your screen? I don't know. What do you mean? You know, well, I just clicked OK. Well, what did it say? Well, I don't know. It was an error message. All right. Well, if it happens now, what do you see, mom? Nothing. Well, what do you mean you see nothing? There's nothing there. Okay. No, I didn't make up. In fact, when I really needed a column, I called my mom. I just started talking about anything. Mom, what'd you do today? My mom is always spotting celebrities. My mom lives in Traverse City, Michigan. No one goes there. But she will call me and she'll say, you'll never guess who I saw today at the Walmart in Traverse City, Michigan. And I'll say, okay, well, who is it? She says, well, he was in that movie. Could you be a little more specific? It was the one where there's a big train crash
I said, "You saw Harrison Ford? Now, which one is he, Harrison Ford?" "Well, he was Indiana Jones." "Okay, not him." "Okay, who did you see?" And eventually we get down to, he was in The Godfather. So The Godfather, and I start naming actors in The Godfather. "No, that doesn't sound right." Then I say, "Al Pacino." She goes, "Al Pacino." I said, "So you saw Al Pacino at the Walmart in Traverse City, Michigan in November?" "Yes." So later I'm at her home, I'm visiting, and she goes, there he is, that's him. And the man looks at the camera and says, "I don't care what you're driving, bring it down, $500, I'll give you $500 trade-in, push it, shove it, drag it in, whatever it is, I'll give you $500 trade right now." I said, "Mom, that is not Al Pacino." "It's not?" Thanks, I love that question. So I'm thinking about being a guy, because guy, we consider ourselves to be tool masters, right? I mean, doesn't every man not only think he can use every tool, but isn't there part of us that we want every tool? Don't you sit down with a tool catalog, you guys in the room, and look through it and say, "Yeah, I could use a high velocity bandsaw. Yeah, not sure what it does, you know, but it looks, yeah." You're pointing to this guy and saying, "Yeah, that's you, right?" Right? So one time I'm staying, I had a career, I worked for a real small family-owned company called General Motors. And they liked to send me on, when I was in sales for them, they liked to send me on junkets. So I went on a junket, which was basically just a bunch of guys in a condo on a beach somewhere in South Carolina. It was a complete waste of time. There were four of us in this condo. My friend Ted was a kind of a strange guy. He and I went to the bar with the other two guys, but we decided to flake early. We went back to the condo, and I said goodnight. A couple hours later, I get up, and I notice that the light is on under the door. So I walk in, and there is Ted standing in the middle of the living room. And I said, "Ted, what are you doing?" Well, this is back during the days of hard contact lenses, and Ted couldn't get one of the contact lenses off of his eye. And he knew if he went to sleep with that contact lens stuck on his eye that that would not turn out well. So he decided that if he stood in the living room, he wouldn't be asleep. That's the kind of guy Ted was. Well, because I'm a man and because I'm a master of all tools, it occurred to me that in this condo that we shared with these other two guys, there was a full kitchen, and in the kitchen there was a full-size refrigerator. And the refrigerator had a freezer, and in the freezer there was an ice maker, and the ice maker had a metal arm that rose and fell with the level of ice, because it got to a certain point and it would shut off the ice maker. And to keep that metal from adhering to the ice, it was covered in a thin, flexible rubber tube that I could remove and use as a device, a tool, if you will, to suck the contact lens off of Ted's eye. So I went into the freezer, I got the thing out, I had Ted lie on the couch, I straddled Ted, I put the tube in my mouth, I leaned over, and I very carefully put the tube on his eye, and at that point, the other two guys walked in. I said, "Yes, gentlemen, this is exactly what it looks like." So I wanted to do a little bit of a reading from The Dogs of Christmas. As I said, it's inspired by a true event, which is my dog, Tucker. And interestingly enough, it takes place in Evergreen, Colorado. So I thought it would be a really nice thing to read to an audience here in Lodo. So I'm going to skip around. This is so because I have discovered that hearing someone read a book, like, every single word can get kind of tedious. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about it, and then I'm going to skip passages. So it's better written than what I'm reading. How's that for? That's kind of been the biggest con job I've ever heard anybody say. It's much better than what you're going to hear. All right, so there's this guy named Josh, and the setting is that he lives in the mountains, obviously by himself. He lives in the foothills of Colorado in Evergreen. The phone rings. He answers it, and the guy says, "Michael, dude, you don't answer your cell phone? I left you like five messages." Josh was frowning, trying to place the voice squawking in his ear. I need your help, buddy. I have a major situation, the caller continued. Sorry, who is this? It's Ryan, your neighbor. Come on, Michael, you remember me. My name's not Michael, was all Josh could think to say. Ryan? Who the heck was Ryan? My name is Josh Michaels. Right, well, okay, that just goes to prove how stressed I am. Josh, right. Remember me, Bruce at the Little Bear? The Little Bear was an Old West-style saloon that had been in the mountain town of Evergreen virtually since there had been an Evergreen. The place was always crowded. Josh sometimes went there because being packed in with so many people gave him the illusion that he was popular. You said to call if I needed any help with anything, Ryan reminded him. Right. You said you tried to light a fire in your wood stove and the house filled with smoke. The last thing anyone would want up here at 8,500 feet, living among lodgepole pines desiccated by Japanese beetles, was for some idiot to burn his cabin down. As Josh recalled, his offer of assistance had been limited to ensuring Ryan didn't set fire to the entire mountainside. Well, this is like that only times 1,000. My brother, you're not going to believe this, got arrested in France. Ryan proclaimed this last word with a triumphant emphasis. Josh waited a moment so that Ryan could explain what this had to do with him. So, he finally prodded. So I need your help, bro. I've got Serena's dog here. Someone needs to watch it. That was Ryan's ex-girlfriend's name, Serena. Well, no, I can't, Josh replied. Dude, I have got to go to Europe. They won't let you take dogs there, and anyway, it's not even my dog, and I have to leave right away on a flight in like 4 hours, okay? Can you hear how I'm really stressed here? Luce and I are coming over. I'll explain it then. Luce? Its name is Luce. What can I tell you? Josh took in a deep breath, but the firm and unequivocal statement he intended to deliver was snuffed out by the dead tone that blanketed the line once Ryan clicked off. Though their homes on the sparsely populated hillside were less than 100 yards apart, Ryan drove over. He was apparently one of those people who kept his vehicle in full-time four-wheel drive because he lived in the mountains and thought that's what you needed to do. Josh watched all four of the oversized tires bite the dirt as the SUV bounded up the switchback. It came to a grinding halt, rocking, and Ryan stepped out of the vehicle. Hey, Josh, Ryan called as if they were the best of friends. Immediately after losing Amanda, Josh had let his hair and beard grow just like Ryan's. The whiskers not bushy exactly, but sculpted into a permanent 10 days growth, the hair brushing his collar. Then, during a teleconference, Josh noticed his clients eyeing him and realized he was pushing people toward a conclusion that they were already willing to embrace, that he was some sort of lone nut living in a cabin on a mountainside. Coding applications in the day and then at night, what? Running with the wolves? Building bombs out of wood pieces? Josh went back to the clean-shaven look, his dark hair short, and now Ryan's woolly appearance, stringy blonde hair down past his ears, reinforced the wisdom of Josh's decision. Ryan looked as if he'd joined a cult that was against grooming. I appreciate this big time, buddy, Ryan said gratefully. I can't do it, Ryan. I've never even had a dog before. I don't know the first thing about taking care of them. Ryan raised his hands to his head and winced as if he were having a migraine. Can I just explain? This is serious. Do you even know what the laws are like in Europe? It's like Canada times 1,000. I have to hire a lawyer who speaks like both French and English. How am I going to do that? My brother's arrested and it's just totally messed up. A canine face, brown and black, rose up in the back of the SUV, looking out the window at the two men. A pink tongue peeped into view. Josh steeled himself. Look, this isn't my problem, Ryan. I'm sorry about your brother, but I can't take a dog. It's impossible. Well, then, what am I going to do? Ryan asked, lifting his arms out to his sides and then dropping them flat to his hips. There's supposed to be a storm coming. I just let the dog go and it'll freeze. There, the dog dies. You're being ridiculous. I'm leaving for Europe, Ryan shouted in frustration. Are you going to help me out here or not? No. That's what Josh was going to say. No, I will not help you out. Get off my property. But he glanced involuntarily at the dog before he spoke, and what he saw in those eyes made him hesitate. Suddenly, he took everything in from Luce's perspective. Its owner gone, something that defied canine explanation. Living with Ryan, a man who felt that a flight to France, a place in Europe, preempted all other concerns, human and otherwise. Ryan probably would just abandon the poor animal, just as he was threatening. Luce would be bewildered and alone. The dog probably would die. Josh faltered helplessly. Ryan saw something in Josh's expression and seized it. Thanks, man, I owe you. Ryan walked around to the back of his SUV. I promise as soon as I get things figured out, I'll call you. This is for like 2 or 3 days max. I have the food right here. Ryan lifted the gate and, with a moment's hesitation, a large dog, marked like a shepherd but with something else mixed in, leaped heavily to the ground. It shook, raised its head to Ryan for a touch that wasn't forthcoming, and then trotted up to Josh, its head lowered and its tail beating the ground submissively. Josh's mouth was open in shock at the sight of the big dog. He put his hand down and was nuzzled with a wet nose, but his surprise choked off anything he might say. And here's a bowl, too, Ryan announced, lugging a brightly colored bag of food up onto the deck and setting down a metal bowl that clanged when it struck the wood. You said this was a male, Josh objected, named Luce. Yeah. Ryan squinted at him while Josh ran his index finger along the name embroidered on the dog's collar. This says Lucy, not Luce, Lucy. Ryan shrugged. Serena always called him Luce. What do I know? Not him, Ryan. It's not him. It's her, Lucy, the female dog, Josh corrected sharply. Fine. Ryan spread his hands in a what's the difference gesture. Not fine. It's not just that she's female. She's obviously pregnant, can't you see? Lucy is a pregnant female dog.
Dogs of Christmas. So needless to say, things get much more complicated for Josh. And I like to say about the Dogs of Christmas that the theme of this book is really a question. Do we rescue dogs or do they rescue us? And it's a story about how ultimately dogs rescue us. Any other questions occur during the reading, the abbreviated reading? I have one more story I want to tell you. And then we can go. And what I'm going to do here, just a reminder, you buy a copy of this book, I will personally donate $2 to Life is Better Rescue. And then the bookstore is also donating to Life is Better Rescue. If you use that little coupon that I was handing out earlier, like they were political flyers, that coupon actually will get you credit for whatever you buy in the store. So, you know, go buy a piano, buy something. A portion of the sale goes to Life is Better, and I'm really proud to participate in that. And I think, Marty, is the process that they go down and buy the book first, or what's the process?
You can buy the book after. You can have re-sign and then go downstairs and just take that little piece of paper. If you forgot it, just say you're with this group and you're buying the book. And the part of the proceeds will go on
Yeah, okay. So I wanted one more animal story. I wanted to tell you about the time that I had to take my son's hamster to the vet. So my son came to me. This is a long time ago. He was a little boy, and he came to me and he said, Dad, there's something wrong with one of his hamsters. He kept these two hamsters prisoner in his room. And I said, what's wrong? And he says, just lying there. And I said, I know what's going on. This is the oldest trick in the book. You're going to go into the cage and see what's wrong with the sick one. The other one's going to sneak up from behind you, hit you in the back of the head, change into your clothes, and escape. Because that's the kind of good father I was. He says, no, Dad, I'm serious. You got to come in and check it out. So I go in, and I look, and sure enough, there is one of the hamsters just sort of lying there, like wriggling a little bit. And I realized what was going on. I said, oh my, this hamster's having babies. And my son said, well, how can that be? Their names are Bert and Ernie. And my two daughters wandered in to see what was going on. And I said, children, we're about to witness the miracle of birth. And they said, ew, gross. And my older daughter said, so what are we going to do with a bunch of little hamster babies? I said, well, I remember that when my parents' dog gave birth to puppies, we went up to the grocery store parking lot with a box full of puppies, and we gave away puppies, and it worked out great. She said, so are we going to hand everybody a pair of tweezers so they can pick out their hamster baby? Because she's that kind of daughter. So we're all looking, and we see that though the Ernie is lying there giving birth, not much is happening. I mean, you can actually see that the baby's starting to come out, but it's like stuck. And I said, oh my God, it's a breech birth. And my son said, well, do something, Dad. So all right, the next time it was like a little foot came out, and I reached down and I grabbed the foot, and I'm just trying to pull the baby. Oh, it's not coming out. Oh. And the foot went back in. I'm like, oh, God. And my son is like, please, Dad, please. All right, the foot comes out again. So again, I'm like, oh, God. So I pull the... Ah. And my daughter said, well, maybe we should dial 911 and have them walk us through this. I said, no, we're taking Ernie to the vet. So we grab Ernie, we put him in a separate cage. All the kids pile into the car. We're driving to the vet. My son's in the back seat. He's going, breathe, Ernie, breathe. My daughter said, hamsters don't do Lamaze. So we get to the vet, and I walk in, and I'm kind of professional. I said, so what do you think, Doc? An epidural indicated? He thoroughly examines Ernie, and he goes, oh, my, oh, my. And I thought, oh, no. And he said, Mr. Cameron, may I speak to you alone for a minute? I'm like, so I took my older daughter with me for moral support. We go to the back room, and he says, well, Mr. Cameron, I don't know what to say. And I said, well, God, what's wrong? Is he dying? He says, oh, no, he's not dying. And he's not giving birth. In fact, that'll never happen because Ernie is a male. I said, well, then, what's going on? He says, well, during adolescence, male hamsters sometimes become, and my daughter says, horny. And he said, I'm glad you understand. And my daughter started to laugh. I said, what's so funny? She said, oh, I'm just thinking of you pulling on his... I said, we are never talking about this, ever. The important thing was, Ernie was okay. We get in the car, we're driving home, and I'm like decompressing. My son says, you know, Dad, I think Ernie's really grateful. My daughter says, oh, you have no idea. Thank you for having me tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.